The Guardian. Hello, I'm Nell Bowes, and this is Science Weekly. On this week's podcast, seconds out, what happens when the gloves come off between scientific rivals?
He was accused of having kidnapped the bones, and he responded very strongly by accusing the Australian Indonesian team of being scientific terrorists.
From Galileo to the Human Genome Project, we examine the petty quarrels and epic battles that have helped further our understanding of the world.
He used to take this roadshow around in which he would demonstrate the dangers of AC current by electrocuting hapless animals.
We go behind the scaffolding as one of the UK's science museums undergoes a multi-million pound redevelopment.
It's anticipated that we will achieve around 1 million visitors once the main building is reopened and the site is restored to its former glory.
Fermilab gets an extension. A top environmentalist wants $100 billion to save the planet. And, shock horror, Stephen Hawking doesn't believe in a supernatural being.
When something is inexplicable in nature, we still are turning to the idea of invisible super beings to be in control of things we don't understand. And I find that genuinely and deeply despairing.
Plus, we have a look at our new website. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the pod. Today we're going to begin by looking at how science really works. All that friendly collaboration, helpful advice and impartial peer review. Balderdash. It's more about arguments, enemies and condemning your colleagues' careers to ruin, apparently. Joel Levy's book is called Scientific Feuds, From Galileo to the Human Genome Project. Joel, hello.
Hello.
So tell us a bit about your book.
The book covers over 30 feuds from throughout the history of science, right from the very beginnings of the early modern period, up to quite modern, very contemporary ones. And apart from telling some very juicy stories about some real ding-dong spats, I hope that what it also does is gets across quite a lot of science.
Can you give us an entertaining example of a feud from your book?
Well, one that's entertaining for us, arguably not so entertaining for some of the animals involved, was the what was known as the War of the Currents in the late 19th century, where Thomas Edison had developed DC power technology and was starting to make a lot of money by rolling out across America. But then another inventor, Nikola Tesla, who's a Serbian inventor, who had actually come to America originally to be employed by Edison, but Edison had effectively cheated him out of money that he promised him. So Tesla went off in a huff and developed the technology for AC power, which he then sold to Edison's great rival, Westinghouse. And so and then they started to roll out their technology for AC power distribution, which actually was arguably cheaper and easier and better. But Edison wouldn't let it lie at that. He was a master of the arts of spin, and he knew that if he could control public perception, then he could still avoid having to expensively retool his industry and license, you know, other people's products. So he started to engage in a very vicious publicity war against AC current, and it became known as the War of the Currents. And somebody that worked for Edison as originally just as a salesman, but then set himself up as an expert electrical engineer. He used to take this roadshow around in which he would demonstrate the dangers of AC current by electrocuting hapless animals, including at one stage he had a show where he electrocuted a dog. First of all, he electrocuted the Newfoundland dog with DC current, and it survived, although it whimpered with pain. And then he killed it with AC current. And the audience didn't like this, and the meeting was roundly broken up. And what I loved was that as Harold Brown was swept off stage, he protested. He said, "I wish this experiment had not been interrupted. I have enough dogs to satisfy the most sceptical." and there was a really gruesome coda to this, which is in 1903, possibly the final animal victim of the War of Currents, was an elephant called Topsy. And poor old Topsy was a circus elephant who had a bad rep because she'd been dragged all around America for years and very badly mistreated, and as a result had killed a couple of a few of her handlers. And in fact, in Brooklyn, one of her handlers had tried to feed her a lit cigarette, and she'd killed him as a result. Anyway, so as a result of this, she'd been sentenced to death. And Edison, obviously not one to miss out on an opportunity, volunteered to electrocute her. And it was pretty grisly show, basically. At Coney Island, she was fed with a pound of cyanide-laced carrots. And then she was fitted with copper-lined sandals and then blasted with 6,600 volts of electricity. And it was all rather grisly. And what was even grisly was Edison filmed the whole thing and then made quite a lot of money.
Was it AC or DC?
It was with AC current, because he was trying to prove the dangers of AC current. Although, in fact, of course, AC current is much worse for electrocuting people, as was proved when Harold Brown invented the first electric chair and convinced New York State, I think it was New York, to use it for the first electric chair execution in America. And this is all part of their drive to show that AC current was really dangerous. And in fact, AC current is the worst. You're much better off using DC current to electrocute someone. And as a result, the execution of the first person to be executed was a murderer called William Kemmler in 1890. And the whole thing was botched. It was horrible. And it took several attempts to execute him. And as Westinghouse himself commented, they would have done better with an axe.
So on a slightly less gruesome note, tell us about some recent feuds.
I mean, one of the most contemporary ones is the pretty vicious feud that over the bones of Flory's Man, a.k.a. the Hobbit, it's more generally known as. And this is a story that's continuing to develop even now. So there's still breaking developments, and there's still a very heated ongoing controversy over the identity of Flory's Man. But what was particularly vicious was the initial feud between the discoverers of the bones, a sort of an Australian-Indonesian team led by Bert Roberts and Mike Morwood, and Indonesian, the doyen of Indonesian paleoanthropologist Tuka Jacobs. Well, not only did he very, very strongly disagree with their interpretation of the findings, but I guess he was opposed to their whole approach to paleoanthropology. But it didn't just stay as a well-mannered discussion in the journals. He was sent the bones to his laboratory, and he wouldn't release them. And in fact, he was accused of having kidnapped the bones. And he responded very strongly by accusing the Australian Indonesian team of being scientific terrorists. He was obviously a very colourful character. I mean, I think one of his more amusing quotes was, because he quite enjoyed a controversy, and he actually compared the controversies you get in paleoanthropology to taking ecstasy at one point. So he's quite a character, obviously. He's not with us anymore. I'm afraid he died in 2007. So he rather drew a line under that feud as far as he was concerned. But obviously the Australian-Indonesian team didn't take this lying down. They were very angry, particularly with claims that their paper wasn't properly refereed. They had a lot to say about that. They claimed that that Nature had cushioned its arse quite carefully by choosing some very good referees, and they
so
basically
the original
dismissed.
The paper was in Nature, and
yeah, exactly.
Suggested that it was a hobbit type man.
Yes, sorry, just to give a background. Yeah, Flory's Man was bones discovered on the Indonesian island of Flores, which seemed to date to remarkably recently, only to about 13,000 years ago. Yet they seem to have been entirely different species of hominin, a new species. And this is absolutely massive implications for the world of paleoanthropology because, for starters, there's only one species of hominin known to have existed since the Neanderthals died out. It has very big implications for the debate over human origins, over the out-of-Africa theory versus the multi-regionalism theory, which is a dispute about whether all humans are descended from a small band that came out of Africa or whether they evolved from a much more dispersed, widespread species over time. And this feeds right into it. And
Jacob refuted it, saying...
Well, Jacob was a multi-regionalist, which means that he believed quite strongly that modern man was developed from a species, probably about something like Homo erectus, who left Africa at least a million years ago and colonized most of the world. And then through interbreeding between regional populations, they gradually evolved across many regions, multi-regions, into modern man. Whereas the team that discovered the Hobbit quite rightly pointed out that, in fact, if their interpretation of the fossils was accurate, it blew a massive hole through the multi-regionist hypothesis, because what we have here is the exact opposite of what the multi-regionists say. We have here a different species of human which has existed in a region but has not interbred, has in fact remained remarkably isolated, and there are big questions about how that's even possible. for so long, up until, you know, very relatively recently.
Robin McKee, we're lucky enough to have Robin in the pod today. You've been following the florist debate for over the past few years.
Yes, indeed. And I totally agree with that interpretation of it. I mean, I don't think there's much doubt, really. You mentioned the multi-regionalism thing. I mean, that was a vicious battle in itself between the out-of-Africa proponents led by people like Chris Stringer at the National History Museum in London and Milford Wolpoff in America. And that was just as bit as nasty as anything else.
It's been a debate that's been, you know, very much in the newspapers and in the media as well as simply in scientific journals. Do you think that's helped? Do you think that's been an interesting process?
Yes, I do. I think scientists have to go out there and battle for it and battle for the public's attention and put the best face forward. I would say but the multi-regionalism is dead. I mean, it's a defunct.
It's a bit like
theater.
A zombie, really, because it keeps getting killed off and then getting back up.
It's one of these theories. It's like any theory will not die until its last proponent is dead, and there are a few still alive. And when they're dead, it will be over, and you know, out of Africa theory will live and rule.
We've also got Ian Sample in the pod today. Ian,
with the ongoing debate over Florist Man, I mean, find more bones. You know, the individuals that they have will not be the only remains on the islands. And so I just hope that, you know, more is going on to build up.
They are still making new findings. Yeah. I mean, I know.
And they're looking on other islands as well.
Yeah. That you reported not long ago on a find of stone tools from like 2 or 3 million years ago.
So Ian's suggesting that all you need in order to resolve the feud is more evidence. Is that actually the case, given your studies of feuds?
Of course, it never works out like that. Because I mean, there's a dictum by Charles Fort that for every expert there's an equal and opposite expert, and I suppose, you know, and the same sort of applies to evidence. For every new piece of evidence, someone's going to contend it. I mean, what's interesting about science is, in theory, you can get an answer. Paleoanthropology is often called the most disputatious of sciences, possibly because you can't get such, you know, a clear answer. And in fact, there's a huge weight of interpretation is placed on individual bones, sometimes even just a tooth. And sometimes people build a whole career on just that. So that's why it's the most contentious science. But there are areas of science, physics, for instance, where you think, well, we can get a clear answer. Which, I mean, as an interesting side point, that actually makes physics quite popular science for making bets in. A lot of physicists like to make wagers because actually it lends itself to that. You can speculate on something and know that, you know, in a few years it might well be proved. But disputation in physics goes right back to the beginnings of science. Galileo and Kepler, for instance, didn't like each other at all. Tycho Brahe, sorry, I always pronounce him wrong.
Tycho
Brahe,
like...
I think.
Tycho Brahe.
Is it right? Yeah, I never get his name right. He had a tremendous fight with a contemporary... he would call himself an astronomer. A guy called Ursus, that was his Latin sort of cognate, the bear. And they had a tremendous scrap in which they accused each other of all sorts of iniquities. And basically, Tycho accused him of plagiarism. And then Ursus accused him of, shot back about it, had to go at him for his silver nose, because Tycho's nose had been cut off in a duel, he'd been disfigured. It was very personal and very nasty. And that's right at the beginnings of the scientific period. So early modern science was frequently characterized by feud. And in fact, arguably the greatest scientist of all time, Isaac Newton, was probably the nastiest scientist of all time, because he was a vicious person. And, I mean, there's a lot of debate about his psychopathology, about what might have been wrong with him. But
notice
his life...
that in the book, you've got a nice little chapter, Was Newton Psychotic?
Yes,
yeah,
there
like
was
that.
Just a little box, yeah. I mean, and there's a strong case to make that he is. In fact, that's how I came to write this book, because I was writing a book about Newton. And he had such vicious feuds, and they were quite interesting. But it just led me on to thinking about this whole area of feuds in science.
And do the feuds, how greatly do they affect the discoveries, or how greatly do they affect our view of the discoveries, you know, hundreds of years later?
Well, there's a strong argument that if you get on the wrong side of them, they can retard science. And Newton's a very good example of that. He had a tremendously vicious feud with Leibniz about priority for who discovered calculus. And in fact, the evidence clearly shows that they discovered it independently, with Newton discovering it slightly earlier. But what was interesting was that Leibniz very quickly saw that to make it useful, it had to have a very accessible notation, which he developed. But because Newton controlled British science to such a degree, because he was so bitterly opposed to Leibniz, it meant that British mathematicians basically weren't allowed or didn't use Leibnizian notation for many years. And arguably, British mathematics lost its sort of lost preeminence as a result.
Which is interesting. Comes back to looking at slightly older feuds when all the proponents are dead and, you know, theory has moved on by several hundred years. What's the historical view on some of these feuds? Do you learn more about them given the lens of
I mean,
time?
I think that one of the historical importance of feuds is really what it tells us about how science works as much as anything. Because there is this kind of nice, bowdlerized Victorian version of science that it's an orderly progress and that it's teams of people working and teaching and teams of students and things like that. And of course, science is like any other field of human endeavor. It's dirty and messy. But it's actually more than that. I mean, there is a very strong argument that the nature of science itself is all about pitting people together. I mean, it's about there's Darwinist interpretation of science, that is ideas and hypotheses competing in a real kind of ready and tooth, you know, way to see who survives, to see which idea survives.
Well, then presumably your fitness is not determined by truth, it's determined by various other factors.
Well, I mean, that's another argument about whether or not science is really the way to truth or whether it's just another way of, you know, looking at the world and there's no more true than...
Do you think that, I mean, with a review of these feuds over time, do you think that we're changing in the way that we approach them or talk about them, or are they becoming, you know, are we growing with big science? Are you kind of creating collaborative projects that are...
Big science has led to big feuds, no right. question about it. And the, you know,
just with more people on either side.
Well, and also still some high-profile individuals. The Human Genome Project was characterised by some vicious feuds, and Craig Venter, who's obviously in the news a lot at the moment, was definitely on one side. He's a very divisive character. I wouldn't say much has changed necessarily. There's an argument to be had about science journalism and how science is portrayed, and there's arguably a journalistic imperative to make things sound worse than they are, or to juice things, to sex up science, and a nice feud is a good way of doing that.
That couldn't be better.
I was going to say, Robin, do you have a nose for a feud when you...
Well, you can't resist that. I mean, and if two parties are divided, and in the case of the Human Genome Project, it wasn't quite us fueling it up. It was pretty fueled up itself. But the other examples can easily be exploited, and I think climate change is one where you've
Would
got
you
something.
Characterise that as a feud?
Well, it sometimes is presented as a feud when it shouldn't be. I mean, 99% of scientists say global warming is man-made, 1% don't. But newspapers continually and still present it as on one side and on the other, and it's really a false dichotomy there. But we still are going to have a debate between Lord King and Lord Lawson about climate change as if there was on one side and on the other. Completely false.
Okay, we'll leave that there for now. Joel Levy's book is called Scientific Feuds, From Galileo to the Human Genome Project, and it's out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, at Science Weekly, we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian science content, follow at Guardian Science. Now it's time to head off to Manchester.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Welcome to MOSI, the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester. There's a huge amount of development work going on behind us. And rather than taking you through all the detail outside, let's go inside. This area here will be a huge gallery. It's called Revolution Manchester, 1,100 square metres, and will feature all of the major innovations and worldwide advances that Manchester has brought to the world. We will focus on various elements such as transport, mass spectrometry, Cottonopolis, energy. And the baby computer was the world's first stored program computer. In truth, it probably had less computing power than your current calculator, but a huge advance, and it was made in the 50s, and it was started here, and is the absolute forerunner of all of computing. The differences between us and the Science Museum in London, we're only 28 years old, they're over 100 and odd years old. They also pull in an awful lot of foreign visitors. I mean, probably about 60% of their visitors are tourists and from international places, whereas MOSI is far more about indigenous population. Greater Manchester will form 70% of our visitor numbers. 10% are international visitors. So we're different. It's an authentic site. The whole site is part of the collections as much as the items within the buildings. This is the original lifting gear for the warehouse. So you've got all of this sort of wood and everything and some lovely bits where it says no more than 3 tons, things like that. Really fantastic. The chain. I know we won't be able to cut it, that's for sure. I would reckon that it's listed with the building. The funding for this really was secured before the major sort of crashes happened in the marketplace. The budget has crept up above the original 7.1 total completion budget to about 8.2. But we're well on our way, only a slight shortfall, and it looks like we'll be open and ready for the public in mid to late October, which is very important for the museum, not just for the funders, but also for our commercial activities. We're now on the top floor. It is a bit like your classic loft space. Conferencing area, which we're in right now, will enable us to function over the coming years by making ourselves more financially sustainable. What will ultimately materialise out of this redevelopment is improved revenue for the museum, and it will maintain us, hopefully, in a free capacity for the general visitor to enjoy and not worry about whether they can afford to visit the museum. Well, it takes a bit of imagination at this moment in time, but in a few months' time, there will be thousands of people flocking through these doors here. Nowadays, people expect so much more from a museum. It's not just about history, it's a visitor attraction, and it's an experience during the day. So that's what we've embedded into the new gallery and this main building. What makes me happy is that more people will come to the museum and more people will understand what MOSI is about, but more importantly, what Manchester has brought to the world.
That was Tony Hill, taking us behind the scenes at Manchester's Museum of Science and Industry. You can watch a video tour of the transformed warehouse at guardian.co.uk/science, and there's a link to that on our Facebook group. Just search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast. Everyone in the room has brought a recent story to have a chat about. So, 30 seconds to explain your story, then we can discuss. Let's go to Robin McKee first. Robin, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got the proverbial Mr. Hawking and God, really not mentioned together. Managed to make this splash in the Times for most of the week because Mr. Hawking, suddenly Professor Hawking, apparently doesn't think God has any place in the origin of the universe, and lo and behold, it's news. And I'm a bit perplexed about it, I think.
Why is it news, do you think?
Because he's got a new book out and the Times is serialising it, to be cynical about it. Having read the book, I think it's quite a rather enjoyable, well-written book. And it's a very nice synthesis of modern cosmological theory, but it's no more than that. And of course, modern cosmological theory has no place of God. I mean, as Laplace once said to Napoleon, you know, I have no need for God in my equations, and it's been ever since that it's been the case. But suddenly, it's news. It's pretty breathtaking, actually.
Ian, you said you were a bit angry about this.
Yeah, and I kind of need to be careful in how I articulate the argument, I think, so I'm not sure I get it across properly. But, I mean, the story was basically saying that Hawking says there's no need for God in creating the universe. And he's always said that. I mean, that's always been his line. And, you know, he basically says that, you know, you can get this stuff with physics alone. But what annoys me sort of far more than this is that it's the 21st century and serious people are debating whether the universe was created by an invisible superbeing. And I think that says a lot about how far we've come or how far we haven't come, where just when something is inexplicable in nature, we still are turning to the idea of invisible superbeings to be in control of things we don't understand. And I find that genuinely and deeply despairing. The other final moan I have about this is, and this is not aimed at the Times, because The Guardian did the same thing last week, not only having really a book driving a front page story, but really a kind of, I don't know if it's willful, but a misinterpretation of what's really being said to give the impression that the news line is actually news, whereas I don't think, you know, this is news. Hawking has never said God created the universe. He said we don't need God to create the universe, and that's what
and
he's maintained.
And now he's reiterated it.
Exactly.
Are you referring also to the Bjorn Lomborg stories that have been around? This is the story that's been out this week. So Bjorn Lomborg, commonly known as the skeptical environmentalist, has released a new book in which he does an economic analysis of what we should be spending money on, and comes out saying, yep, $100 billion a year on research and development and new technology to combat anthropogenic global warming would be a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So Lomborg, his first book, you know, The Skeptical Environmentalist, he was saying in it, yes, you know, climate is changing, there are environmental issues, but they are not the be-all and end-all. They are not the highest priority in his mind, that, you know, given a certain amount of cash, he would rather divert it into dealing once and for all, if you can, with third world, developing world diseases like malaria and such like.
And that comes from his political science background.
Absolutely, absolutely. And his new book, he says that, you know, the dealing with climate change has moved up the priorities. Now that is interesting. What I think is unhelpful is when Lomborg is painted as being primarily or previously a kind of climate skeptic. Although he called himself the skeptic environmentalist, climate skeptics suggest that he didn't believe that global warming was happening, that he was skeptical of the science behind it. He was skeptical of society's response to it. And these might sound like subtle differences. I don't think they are. I think they're very clear differences in what someone is saying and what someone believes. They're also very important. And I think to kind of, for me, those distinctions were blurred in our own coverage. And I didn't think that was helpful, which made me angry again.
He's a very angry man. Joel, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got a story which is kind of small in itself. And the headline is Panel Throws Tevatron a Lifeline, which is that Fermilab in America, that have got a report suggesting that the operations of their massive collider Tevatron should be extended until 2014. And reading between the lines, what they're doing is they're saying that they want to fund the Tevatron's continued hunt for the Higgs boson, basically so that it can engage in a race, if you like, with the massive LHC collider at CERN in Switzerland. And I think it's interesting this because, apart from the fact that we've got a real sort of scientific race developing here, it also feeds into a really big feud that's brewing up over priority for the discovery of the Higgs boson, because it's generally believed there might be a Nobel Prize imminent for people who at least posited the existence of the Higgs boson. But because you can only give a Nobel Prize to three people at once, and there's six people who claim this priority, some people are going to be left out, and some people are already very unhappy about that.
Ian Sample, author of a recent book on the LHC. What's your take
on the
Nobel
story
Prize,
of the Higgs itself, actually? well, what's interesting that may separate this from other feuds that we've been talking about is that the... frankly, it isn't a feud, because what you have are six people who published the idea of this kind of mass-giving mechanism in 1964. They all published it around the same time. But one group of those, there's three guys who were one of the groups,
their argument is not really with the other scientists, it's with the scientific community. And they strongly believe, at least two of them strongly believe, that the Europeans are trying to write them out of history. Two of the guys are American. They believe that the Europeans are trying to write them out of history. If you get rid of those three, you're left with three. And lo and behold, the Nobel Prize can go to a maximum of three people. And you know, there are some people who say, well, look, guys, you published last. There aren't many, you know, areas in things in the world where you get a prize for coming last. But, you know, this is the nature of the debate.
Can't we wait for another sort of 4 to 6 years or something until they die and the last three alive get the prize?
Well, do it that way. That has happened before.
It's also quite an interesting insight into the way that science is not just a nice, clean process with discoveries made, that it's very much the human factor. And it's very interesting what you say about them trying to rewrite history a bit. And in fact, recently the LHC organised a conference or something on the subject of the Higgs boson, and very carefully put only the names of three of the claimants in the name of the conference, I think, which in itself caused a big spat, and there was something of a furore over that. And then there was a talk given at that conference in which some pretty intemperate language was used. So tempers are already running high, and there haven't even been any prizes given out yet.
Our last story of the week, Ian, what have you got for us?
I was interested in this story that came from the UK's chief environment scientist, Bob Watson, and he is saying that the government has to be more open about what it calls its cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. And there is a kind of a line that's trumpeted by government that UK emissions have greenhouse gas emissions have fallen about 50-60% on 1990 levels. And this is all very relevant to the Kyoto Protocol and subsequent deals on reducing our carbon impact. And what he's saying is that this government knows that this is the case, but what happens is these figures fail to include or take account of the fact that we've exported a hell of a lot of our manufacturing. We don't really make much anymore, but we get it done in developing countries and then import the stuff back in. So we're still consuming all of this stuff. We are driving the carbon emissions. It's just the carbon emissions are being released in a country where labor is cheaper. And he's saying you have to build that in, because we are the consumers that are producing those, that are responsible for those carbon emissions. And he says, interestingly, if you take those into account, then our emissions have actually gone up about 12% rather than down 15%. And he's really just calling for a little bit more openness on this. The problem is it's a nightmare to sort out, because if you import something from a country, that could involve components from all over the place. So how do you know how many tons of carbon were produced for each component? How do you audit this for everything that we import? It's tough.
And does it in the end become an exercise that takes more time and admin and effort than is actually worth it?
And is there a danger that you actually try and, you open this can of worms and try and sort them all out into coherent shapes, while not doing anything about what you really,
what you could spend at least a decade on sorting.
It could be an awful diversion, but it is important. So I don't envy them.
Thanks very much, everyone. Links to all these stories can be found on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast while you're there, so every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player.
Science Weekly.
If you're a regular on our website, you'll have noticed an addition to our little ecosystem, a whole raft of new science blogs. They cover everything from politics through particle physics to evolutionary biology. We've got some superb voices, and I do recommend having a look round and joining the debates. You can find them at guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. It just remains to say thank you to Joel Levy. His book, Scientific Feuds, is out now. Thanks also to our panel, Ian Sample and Robin McKee. Next week, we've only got Richard Dawkins and David Attenborough on the programme. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Nell Bowes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.